All right. Hi, everybody. It's RCFB Talk 62. My name is Bodak Hyeri, and it's great to have you all with us. We're going to be joined by my usual hosts, JD and Sirius. Tonight, we're taking your calls and your thoughts on college football as we get closer to the season. Yeah, so JD, we have some other things we've been going on this week that we just wanted to mention to our audience.
Yes, absolutely. So first and foremost, we are very, very excited to announce our first ever foray into NIL, if you will. You can now get brand new RCFB licensed merch from Home Field Apparel. You can get their insanely comfortable shirts with RCFB's brand. And if you haven't already ordered from them before, you're trying to figure out, hey, they've got these awesome licenses from more than 120 different college football teams and universities. You can use promo code REDDITCFB, that's REDDITCFB, to get 15% off your first order. Home Field Apparel is also the sponsor of our annual Pick'em contest. We're very excited about this new enhanced prize package that we now have on Reddit CFB, and you can join our Pick'em contest free of charge. Our grand prize winner this year is going to get an RCFB shirt, three items of their choice from Home Field Apparel, and thanks to a very generous donor, a brand new Yeti Roadie cooler. It's going to be an incredible prize package. There's prizes all the way from first to fifth place. Strongly recommend that you go ahead and sign up on that on Reddit CFB. And of course, that is free to play. And also, speaking of free to play, we're bringing back another very popular feature from last year, and that is RCFB Book. RCFB Book is a mock sports book where you can go ahead and place your wagers with fake internet points and try to see if you can actually stack up against the pros. We pull official lines for the upcoming games of the week. You can place down parlays, you can do straight ups. It's an incredible opportunity that you can have to go ahead and play with some free, again, mock points. There's no money involved in it, but it's available on redditcfb.com. It is one of several exciting things that we have for the upcoming season on the actual main site.
And welcome, Sirius. Anyway, with all that out of the way, because we had a lot of things going on. I mean, with the season coming up, we just thought we'd mention all of these things as well as again. And we'll talk about the coming schedule again at the end of the talk. But really, we want to hear from you. So first up, let's see here. Brizo Souvenir Company. Thanks for your patience. We'd love to hear from you. What's up?
Hey guys, hope your evening's going good. I had a couple questions about all the conference realignment. I just wanted to get your thoughts on it as well. With how messy UCLA's situation with the California system is, do you think, like, if they have to stay in whatever pack number you want to say now, conference in a couple years, what do you think will happen to that conference? Do you still think the Big Ten will go after like Washington, Oregon, maybe throw in a Stanford, Cal? And what do you think if that does happen, to pick the Big 12 would pick off the four corners?
Wow, there's a lot going on there. But I think, first and foremost, I really think what's going on right now with the UC Regents and the chancellors and all of that stuff is honestly not going to amount to much. I think what we have here, and I mean, it makes sense. It's a giant state university system, and the UC system is basically the premier state university system in America, just from the sheer size and the overall rank from campus to campus, not in sports, but just in sort of academic research and prestige. I mean, UC Santa Barbara, people don't realize they have like eight Nobel laureates, but they have played D1, so we don't really talk about it. But all of that said, there's a lot of reasons why I doubt they're going to force UCLA to stay. Now, I think this is the opportunity to get, I think, to vent basically. And I think this is the classic adage, and I know I'm guilty of this when I advise people. It's easier to ask for forgiveness than to ask for permission. And I think that's kind of what we're seeing at play on a really high stakes level with UCLA just deciding to bounce to the chagrin of their UC system mates. But that said, one thing we can say is that apparently. And Brett McMurphy, he's a pretty solid reporter. It seems like Oregon's already kind of in that process of potentially going to the Big Ten. Their reports are they're in discussions to see if that could happen. My favorite response to that is that, you know, if they do go, will they tweet, you know, Scrooge McDuck jumping into a money bin? I'm not sure, but certainly that's a feasible possibility. Now, what other teams they take, whether it would be a Washington or a Bay Area team or both, is up for grabs there. One thing I will say, and, you know, I was gone for quite a bit of the last week and a half because I had to do some traveling, but I just remember, you know, it was on the other hemisphere. I was in Europe, but you go to a store there and, you know, they'll have generic America shirts that kind of sell because the brands are popular. You'll see, you know, musical groups, you'll see Harvard, you'll see Yale, and then you'll see UCLA, like no other D1 program. So that I thought was kind of interesting, but I've seen that before. I mean, I remember, gosh, back in 2005, after I just finished grad school, I took a trip to China, and you go into a department store and it is like UCLA sports only. So the brand has national cachet, even if the athletic department is sort of lagging at times. So again, I think a lot of people were initially surprised that it was USC and UCLA and not just grabbing another school from another area. But that part, I will say, all of that said, whether or not Big 12 goes after those four corner schools, I think we're sort of in this weird detente, and not even detente, that's the wrong word. I think we're in this weird moment of just quiet before another storm, because something's going to have to give. The Big 12 needs to, and the Pac-12, depending on who's left, need to do something to assert relevance and try and stay in that P5 and not kind of get diluted into, you know, sort of a, I don't know, a middle tier or wherever you want to say it. So we're going to see something. I think it's just a matter of which shoe's going to drop first. And I think ultimately it's the most lucrative option. So, you know, who the Big Ten might take next before we'll see any of the rest personally. But that's my thought. I'm still wondering about that random tweet we saw. Was it, and JD, you might know this, was it the TCU president who suddenly did a tweet from Chicago, or was it?
Yeah, athletic director.
It was Nani, who we had on a few weeks ago. That's wild.
Friend of the program.
Friend of the show. JD, serious, what do you guys have to think about this?
Just real quick, I thought the interesting thing on the Oregon Big Ten news was the fact that apparently zero decision makers were in the room for that first meeting. The Oregon athletic director and president, who I guess is outgoing, neither of them were there, and Kevin Warren wasn't there. So it's like, was Oregon really having a meeting with the Big Ten, or did like a couple of people who happened to be associated with both groups were just like in the airport at the same time and decided to like stop and say hi to each other? It was just kind of really weird in terms of, you know, like it's kind of news, but also not really news because it's, you know, like multiple stages away from actual decision makers. So I thought that was kind of weird.
Phil Knight desperately driving around Chicago, begging through texts, where is Kevin Sumlin's house? That's literally all it was. That's all that rumor is.
You know, but it kind of reminds me of sort of the old spy craft from the Cold War. Like, I don't know if you saw Bridge of Spies is probably my favorite example of that. Random people speaking on behalf of the government. It's actually, you know, somebody on behalf of Oregon and somebody on behalf of the Big Ten. Because I do know, to some extent, a lot of these things, they do try to solve some of this behind closed doors before they announce it. I mean, obviously, the clearest example of that is the fact that no one knew about USC and UCLA until, you know, the moment they announced. So, I mean, who knows? That could be it. But we'll see. I mean, all of it will come out in the end. We'll see where that goes. That's definitely been one of the more exciting things to go. And I want to, you know, that was a great question. What, by the way, before we say goodbye to you, what was your team? What's your team?
So I went to Iowa State, so Big 12, and I may get some flack for this, but I also enjoy watching Ohio State.
I don't think there's flack for that. If you enjoy watching a team, you enjoy watching a team. I think, I mean, hell, we enjoy watching every team on our CFP. So, you know, I think that more power to you. Thanks for joining us. That was a great question. It was a great way to open.
I got one more, if I may. Is this finally the cycle of realignment where Notre Dame has to join someone?
Boy, I know, JD, you were about to unmute, but I just saw that headline that they might get a really nice deal out of this. So if they get enough money, I don't think they will. But as somebody put it, they're getting still what sounds like Purdue money. They're not quite getting that, except in the Big Ten payout. What do you think, JD?
I mean – Notre Dame has always really loved their independence. It's been a cherished tradition for them. And right now they're going to be looking at somewhere between that like $75 million to $100 million a year contract. And they're going to get something pretty high for that, for being an independent, being able to schedule the schedules that they want. And, you know, this is a team that they're going to want to continue doing their traditional games against Navy, against, granted, USC would still continue in the Big Ten most likely, but against Stanford, and be able to do that national type of scheduling, national type of audience. So I don't necessarily see them going into there unless, you know, something comes back and goes, in independence, we can only max out at $50 million. But already the reports are already out there. It's at least going to be $75 million. Notre Dame's going to be in fine financial position. I find it very unlikely that they're going to go into the Big Ten for a reason that I think, you know, has already been stated before. USC and UCLA seemingly came out of nowhere this offseason to join the Big Ten. If there is going to be continued expansion before we were going to start to see some stuff happen this season, it would have already been announced. I don't think it makes sense just to announce two and then hope for one more to be added. If it was all going to come together, it would have already all come together at this point.
My hill to die on is that John Swofford's like legacy is going to be the fact that he had Notre Dame in the bag in 2020 and he let them get away by just saying, oh, well, you can, you know, be a full ACC member this year, but that's it. You don't have to do it, you know, into the future. And man, talk about letting the golden goose slip away from you.
Yeah, they were maybe a little too nice. Well, a Midwest nice thing. I could see that being upper Midwest. Based here in Minnesota. Anyway, Garrett, you've been patient. We'd love to hear from you.
Well, thanks for having me on, guys. I think everybody else is just as excited as I am. We're counting down the days, and I'm actually really excited that, for me, it's ironic. I'm going to be off at a wedding this weekend, and week zero is going to be going on. And here in the great state of Michigan, obviously, it's nice that we'll be able to handicap some games. So, I guess that's the most exciting part for me this year, at least for this opening weekend of our favorite sport.
Absolutely. Who's your team?
So I grew up watching Michigan. My dad went there, and then I have a sister of mine who went to Central Michigan, so I'm a big Mac guy. I didn't go to either. Well, the school I went to here in Michigan doesn't actually have a football team, so I got to basically just pick the teams I wanted, which was kind of nice in some ways. But pretty either way, I mean – what's up?
That's a free agency. You can be whoever you want.
Basically, yeah, it was kind of nice in that regard. I mean, the school I went to technically was an affiliate at one point in Michigan State, but I would probably say it aligned more with like Central Michigan and the University of Michigan living up here. And before I get into my questions, I'll say this. I do love the – well, actually, this goes into my first kind of comment I have. I think it's nothing more to me, as someone who's grown up in the Midwest and in the Great Lakes, nothing more in me loves seeing the pettiness and the arrogance that the Southeast Conference and the Southeastern people have, that this massive, you know, media rights deal is signed and, oh, well, the SEC always gets everything right, when in all reality, the Big Ten's always had very good football. It's always been a very quality institution. I think this year in general, and I guess the big question I have is, I guess, is the Big Ten going to be the most boom or bust conference this year? In my opinion, I think it is. I just think with the quarterback play, there's a lot of experienced guys that can also turn into being inexperienced guys. And I think there's a lot of question marks and also a lot of certainty in the conference, especially at the top.
I mean, first and foremost, I think Ohio State is going to look like an excellent team this year, and that is by far and away the Big Ten's best chance of being able to be a really big boom this year, be able to play in a national championship game, compete for a title. Of course, you know, you're going to be looking at Michigan State. How do they rebuild without Kenneth Walker? You're going to be looking at Michigan wondering, does Jim Harbaugh repeat after losing his coordinators? There's a couple of questions like that that still remain for the Big Ten. But right now, I think more than anything else, the Big Ten needs to be able to prove that they can win in big games and they can win in the game that really matter. Like one of the things that immediately strikes me for last year was when Oregon ended up beating Ohio State. That took a really big hit against the Big Ten's credibility for a moment because it finally looked like, hey, the Big Ten, you know, traditionally, you'd be able to have these kind of strong performances against other Power Five conferences, be able to show out well in these non-conference games. But the marquee game of Oregon and Ohio State, that was Oregon winning a game that, you know, was a game that didn't necessarily seem that Ohio State ever had in its control. It was Oregon just kind of like went in and sat on Ohio State until time expired. I think if we're going to see a boom year from the Big Ten this year, we're going to have to need to see results that's not just, you know, Michigan winning the conference and getting to the playoff game. It's looking competitive against the Georgia. It's not going to just be, you know, Ohio State getting into the playoffs. It's going to have to be, will there be another Michigan State New Year's Six appearance? Will we see something out of the Big Ten West with a Wisconsin or an Iowa or someone else like that going out and showing up in a big bowl game? I mean,
so in other words, JD, sorry to cut you off. So in other words, it almost sounds like you're looking for consistency across the board and not a top heavy result, I guess, from the big players you're expecting results from.
Yes, absolutely. Because one of the things is, you know, you can argue all day about the SEC being a top heavy conference. But the fact of the matter is Alabama and Georgia were in the national championship game last year, both very deservingly so. And when you look at those guys who can go from top to bottom, who's getting success in non-conference games, who's getting success in bowl games, the Big Ten needs to be able to show that it can do both this year to really prove that they can do that. And I'm fascinated to see what's going to happen with that this year.
Well, and I think what's interesting to me is there's a lot of teams that have what ifs behind them, like Michigan State, like you said, the what if. I think Maryland, the what if is, can they put it all together with Talia Tagovailoa, obviously? Can Penn State silence all the haters? You know, can Nebraska or is Nebraska? You know, there's a lot of questions that I get that, especially out west. Another thing I guess I wanted to go into would be Michigan related. That offense obviously last year took another step, especially later in the season under Josh Gattis. And obviously, you know, you kind of saw the emergence of Donovan Edwards. You know, JJ McCarthy came on a little bit at the end there. You know, they get Ronnie Bell back. I mean, is it safe to say that, yes, there's a lot of questions defensively? We don't know exactly what's going to happen. I mean, am I wrong to think that this is probably one of the best Michigan offenses I've seen in my lifetime? I mean, I'm 30 years old, so I've seen the Mike Hart years, the Braylon years. I've seen, you know, I haven't seen the Anthony Carter years or Desmond Howard, but I've been around long enough to have seen some football, and I remembered the last time that they had won a Big Ten title prior to this last year. So, I mean, I don't think it's that far-fetched to say that even though Jim took longer to do it, I think he's got himself one of the most lethal offenses. Now, I think not just in the Big Ten, but in the country.
The question would be is, you know, Josh Gattis isn't there. He's in Miami now. So is Harbaugh going to be able to sustain that? And I think that's one of the reasons why I know, like, trying to put together a top 25 for the RCFB poll, when I was doing it, you know, Bama, Georgia, Ohio State, those are three easy picks for, in some order, the top three. But then what do you do with, like, the rest of the top 10? Because there's so many programs that either lost serious talent or they lost a coordinator, or they lost a coach, and they're having to replace the entire staff. So there's just so many unknowns right now, because we saw a lot of turnover at top programs that we don't normally see. You know, the OU-USC move with Lincoln Riley, with Brian Kelly going from Notre Dame to LSU. Like, there's just so much that changed. And even, like, Mario Cristobal going from Oregon to Miami, teams that could have been easy top 10 picks, top five picks, that now you're like, well, I don't know where to put these guys. I mean, they could come back and not miss a beat and just keep right on rolling, or they could take a whole, you know, 1, 2, 3 years to retool and adapt and everything. I mean, even Ohio State, I think that they've only got, according to their defensive coordinator, maybe like 75% of his scheme installed so far. Like, even for a program that's as stacked as that is, that's as well-developed as that is in a mature program, they're still working out the kinks. So, yeah, Michigan had a great offense last year, but are they going to be able to build on it? Because, you know, I think that was one of the big knocks against Harbaugh, the past few years has been that, you know, he came into Michigan with this reputation of being a QB whisperer, and then he never really developed quarterbacks the way that everybody thought he could, you know? So that,
yeah, and I think the inconsistency too, as well, right? The inconsistencies as well.
So without, you know, Josh Gattis there, I mean, he was seemed to be a pretty key aspect of getting this offensive renaissance going for Michigan. How well has Harbaugh been able to replace him? How much of that is going to be able to carry over from last year to this year? They've proven that they can win the Ohio State game. Like, that's big. That's a huge confidence booster. But they still have to be able to do, like, the little stuff along the way, the X's and O's, in order to be able to actually repeat the full season's performance.
And I think next year, like, I think this upcoming year will be a good test, because it's good to do it once, right? Like, it's a very similar adage I use in college basketball. It's when you win a national title, you get into the club, right? They let the door open for you, you get into the club. But then in order for you to have a seat, an actual good seat at the table, you need to do it again. You know, Harbaugh won a Big Ten title and he beat Ohio State for the first time in his tenure there. Great. That's awesome. Like, that's fantastic. I love that about that, you know, and seeing that, especially at the Big House. But I think it's doing it again and setting the consistency level that's the biggest thing. And I guess kind of going back to your other point about the top 10, I mean, I think this, in my opinion, chime in if you think that you agree or disagree. I mean, this year there is a lot of unknown, but this year also is just a lot of – this year just feels like the most uncertain, yet almost the most exciting offseason in a lot of ways because of the uncertainty. I mean, we know that obviously the top three or four teams are there, but like, we don't necessarily know how Utah is going to respond with a full year of Cameron Rising. Is Baylor going to be for real? Is that number one recruiting class that Texas A&M had legit? I mean, we you know, there's a lot of answers there. You know, how does Notre Dame respond with the fact that they, in some people's eyes, made an A-plus hire in Marcus Freeman? Like, we just don't know. I mean, we truthfully don't know how that's all going to pan out. And so overall, I think I'm excited for the year. One last thing I'd probably leave you guys with and the listeners is, if you're looking for, if your team's kind of, if you're looking for a power or a group of five running back or offensive player to watch out for, Lou Nichols at Central Michigan, by far one of the best, most explosive running backs in the country. And I think you could see his name, you know, skyrocketing up boards as we head in towards the later part of fall and then heading towards the combine. And then, you know, maybe even day two or day three of the draft. So I guess I'll leave you guys with that, but I appreciate the appreciate you letting me on, and I guess I'll just you know, sit back and listen to the banter.
Thanks, Garrett. Yeah, to speak to your comment, I'm pretty excited for the season because I don't know what's going to happen because there's so much uncertainty, at least to start off. I mean, it could be chalk all the way through, right? And like, nothing changes, Bama goes wire to wire. But there's the potential for a lot of interesting things to develop and some interesting storylines as we see how these new coaches, new coordinators perform. And going back to your first point about, is the Big Ten going to be the biggest, you know, kind of like boom or bust conference? I personally think maybe the Big 12, because Baylor, Oklahoma, and Oklahoma State, all three have the potential to be ranked high, potentially to make a college football playoff. But they all have question marks, and it'll be interesting to see how things go this season, to see, you know, what's going to shift around there. And we've got some new coaches in the conference that could come out of nowhere and make a splash. So it's going to be interesting to see what happens in the Big 12, I think.
Yeah, and to piggyback off of that, the reason that I think I'm so amped up for this season, and maybe the most amped up I've been for a season in such a long time, is that specific uncertainty. Because when you look back at when college football was always the greatest, whenever we had the best seasons, it was in years of absolute pandemonium. Like, everybody will say that 2007, probably the greatest sport or greatest year in the history of the sport. And that was a year where the number two lost on a regular basis. We had two lost teams in the national championship. The only teams that didn't end up having two or more losses were the Kansas and Hawaii. I mean, this, when we have that type of uncertainty, those are the type of seasons that come out. This is when we get something like 1990, where Georgia Tech and Colorado are splitting a national title because we have instances like Colorado getting a fifth down. This is when we have instances like 1984, when BYU, after a Holiday Bowl win, is considered the national champion. This is when we get the crazy, wacky years that make college football such an incredible sport.
You know, just to the one thing that, and this is something I've wanted to actually follow up on from actually early on in Garrett's comments, was I'm thinking the game that's really interesting to me, the one that at least in terms of the Big Ten as an entire conference, and it's not necessarily entirely fair to put it all in one team in one game, is going to be that opener with Notre Dame and Ohio State. I think if Ohio State wins that game, and interestingly enough, I have some strong questions of whether or not Notre Dame might be a little overrated, especially, I mean, what are they in the AP poll right now? They're number eight, pardon me, they're number five. So you got number two versus number five. Number five's got a new head coach. That, to me, I'm a little wondering if Ohio State kind of rolls right in there and just, you know, takes him out. I don't know. And maybe I'm wrong. Maybe Notre Dame is going to be stronger. But to me, there's so many questions when you just change a head coach abruptly. We'll see. Of course, at the same time, there's plenty of great examples of a head coach taking over after a successful head coach, having a great first, even second year, and then sort of petering off as they've had their 3 and 4 and 5 years. I mean, I think, you know, oh my gosh, what's his name? The Miami 2001. Oh my gosh, what's his head coach, guys? Larry Coker. I still remember one time somebody called him Uncle Fester, and I cannot get it out of my head. Like, you know, the resemblance is a little uncanny there. But yeah, the Larry Coker at Miami effect could be in there too. But I'm really curious. That's going to be a lot of hype, I think, fairly or unfairly, for the entire conference. I mean, who knows? It could be Michigan State gets it together and really is the dynamite team in the Big Ten. We don't know. Could be, you know, Michigan. Could be, you know, theoretically Penn State. Well, no, theoretically it could be a team in the West, but, you know, they don't appear to necessarily be the champions of the conference. I think that's the worst thing going for the Big Ten right now, is so much of the strength right now is in the East Division. But anyway, Garrett, that was a lot of great stuff to go over. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, I appreciate it. I'll be tuning in. Hopefully this is something more frequent during the season. And I think, as this goes on, I'm definitely going to be tuning in as much as I can. And I'm excited to hear what everybody else has to think and sharing the anticipation together. So, thanks for having me on. Go Blue and fire up Chips.
Thank you. You know, and just to kind of mention that it's so funny, for the longest time, and most of you have been listening for a long time, we've been doing Tuesday nights, usually just hearing from callers with an occasional guest. And then starting in about June, we started to get more and more guests, and we typically would try to fit them on Tuesday nights. And then we decided, you know, let's try and spread the guests around normal days, because we stopped having these general kind of call-in nights. So about July, we decided let's try and clear Tuesday nights, but we had so many already planned, it took until like 2 weeks ago to finally get a Tuesday night where we didn't have a guest. So going into the season, we're going to try and keep these Tuesday nights for just hearing from you guys, because we enjoy it. That's what we've enjoyed the most. And we did so many of our, so much of it is hearing from the rest of you out there on Twitter. So anyway, all that said, we've got a lot of callers. Gators, you've been really patient. We would love to hear from you. Gators Unite, sorry. Just hit, there you go.
Hey, yep, yeah, sorry. I was kind of zoning out there. But no, I just wanted to say hello and join the conversation. I didn't know what you guys were talking about tonight, though. Just super pumped for this year for Utah. Interested in what you guys think on our matchup with Utah, week one. Thank you.
Well, I think one of the crazy things is I have yet to see any kind of consensus of what somebody is expecting with Billy Napier's first year at Florida. I think it's been all over the place of he could compete for the SEC East. He could go 5-7. We don't know what necessarily to make of this team so far, except for the fact that he now has a ton and ton of staffers. I think there was a photo by the team that showed, you know, all the people in jerseys and all the people in polos. And I believe it was Ross Dellinger with Sports Illustrated who pointed out, you know, there's about 115 or so players players and 144 staffers in those blue polos in that photo. So I think if anything else, I think everybody is eager to watch that game, especially to see what, you know, Florida is made up of this year. We kind of saw a team that quit under year four of Dan Mullen. They just kind of decided, pack it in, we're putting it out, we're done with all of this. But now we're going to see, you know, do they have a reignited fire and they go back to that team that made it to so many New Year's Six games? Do they become a very strong number two in the SEC? Do they become a program that can start to like fight against Georgia and have a really strong cocktail party? I'm really curious to see that because we already kind of know what Utah looks like with a Cam Rising. We already kind of know what Kyle Whittingham is going to do on defense. We already know how he's going to try to game plan this. Billy Napier, still kind of an unknown to a lot of different people. And I'm really, really fascinated to see what's going to happen with this game because it'll be our first real taste of, you know, what happens with this Florida team this year and if Billy Napier is actually turning that culture around.
Yeah, and I don't think this game will define him. Like, he's, I think most of Gator fans, I think it's going to take some time. Utah is, like, legit. Their tight ends scare me. And Rising, right? I watched all their games like twice in the last few days. But Cam Rising's better than I thought. So, it does. I mean, it would be huge for a win for just momentum and narrative nationally. But he's going to get a turnaround, as you see, with the Army's already built. The recruiting's going to get turned around. And the players have bought in. So I think we're maybe about 40% to win the game one, but and we have a tough schedule the rest of the year, so just hoping the fan base has some patience and gives him time because he's gonna get it done. So that's what I have to say on that.
I have to say the Gators do have the advantage of playing at home. I mean, the Swamp is still no joke, and I can't imagine, you know, it's gonna be really hopping being the first game of, you know, the Napier season and tenure at Florida. I can imagine the atmosphere is going to be really buzzing there. So Utah is a strong team, and I think that's going to be, as we said, you know, they've got a lot of starters returning, they've got talent, and they've got strong, certainly, you know, coaching, cogency across the board, but it's Florida at home. That's going to be, and I don't know, they have some crazy streak winning at home.
Of course, a Pac-12 team.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, if it were in Salt Lake City, I'd be a little bit more worried for Florida. But this I think is, I'm not going to say it's in the bag, but it definitely Florida is going to be stronger than they might be otherwise. So this is, but I want to see this game. This is going to be really interesting for both programs to see where they are.
I'm looking forward to the Billy Napier versus Brian Kelly recruiting battles in the state of Louisiana, and just try to see how Brian Kelly and his recruiting family can do against a guy who's got such good roots in that state. And I mean, he's already going to have a leg up in the state of Florida, which has extremely rich recruiting grounds to begin with. So I think that could be interesting to see.
For sure. Yeah.
He's a little behind from what I've heard. Kelly's a little behind right now, but you know, LSU recruits Louisiana for itself. You know, they still want to play for that, you know, purple and gold.
Well, winning fixes everything, too. So if either one of them has a big season and the other one doesn't, then that can change a lot of your recruiting rankings in a hurry.
Which also for right now, obviously, things are going to change. But, you know, number six in the country is not necessarily a bad class for LSU right now. I feel very confident that we especially get to see some of these recruiting battles coming up. It's going to be really, really fun to see what happens in the SEC with all these coaches, with these huge contracts and huge expectations.
Absolutely. Well, Gators, thanks for joining us.
Hey, thank you, guys.
No, thank you. Trey, you've been patient. We'd love to hear from you.
Yeah, I want to piggyback off of the last person speaking about the interesting openers. University of Arkansas hosting Cincinnati, which a couple years ago, seeing that on a future schedule, I thought was an interesting matchup. Now it becomes an extremely interesting matchup. Then also my Razorbacks go to BYU, host Liberty, and then host our old coach, Bobby Petrino from Missouri State. And then we have the rest of the SEC. So I just kind of want to get your thoughts on the home opener, University of Arkansas versus Cincinnati, which last year I didn't expect that to be a big game opening up. And then also this kind of, you know, almost written like a screenplay schedule of just a weird mix of teams for an SEC team to play.
I mean, first and foremost, my main question for this Arkansas schedule is just why? Why? This is one of the most absurd schedules that I've seen for an upcoming season. And, you know, it's one of those things where it's not necessarily, you know, you're not going against super heavy hitters from every single conference, but you have picked a schedule that can only be described as pesky, which is the worst type of schedule to possibly make. I mean, let's break this down. So first off, you've got the opening home game, which is against Cincinnati, which is a college football playoff participant last year, one of the best G5 teams coming into this season. Luke Fickell, I think, is the real deal, but you start off with that. Your FCS tune-up is welcoming Bobby Petrino back to Arkansas, which I don't think that we as a society are prepared for yet or have talked enough about yet. That's an absurd FCS game to go ahead and schedule. And then, you know, you're going on the road in October to BYU. You're going up to Provo in order to play a non-con game. And then if that wasn't enough, Hugh Freeze is coming back with Liberty in November. This is the most absurd schedule I think anybody could have just written up as an opportunity. And that's not even mentioning, you know, you're going to have your typical games against Texas A&M. You're going to be hosting Alabama. You're going to be playing Auburn. You're going to be playing LSU. You're playing Lane Kiffin and Ole Miss. You have a wild schedule in here, but it also makes sense of why, you know, this last offseason, Arkansas rewarded Sam Pittman with essentially the Mark Stoops deal of win 7 games, you get a contract extension. But this is an absurd schedule for this year, and I cannot believe that your AD signed off on this.
JD, you know the worst thing about a schedule like this?
What
is it? If you go 4-0 in your non-con, you have trashed those teams, well, three of their seasons, and you beat your FCS team, which means you're going to get zero credit for this from the pollsters. Because you've taken all the wind out of the sails of BYU, Liberty, and Cincinnati, who need those Power 5 wins in order to actually gain momentum. So their odds of being ranked have gone down pretty low. And that's your reward for actually going 4-0 against a deceptively strong and, as you said, pesky schedule when it comes to your non-con. And then you've got to go and play your regular season matchup in one of the toughest divisions in the entire country. It's just... It is bad, bad timing for the Razorbacks in terms of risk versus reward.
Yeah, well, I think when we did most of the scheduling, it was during the Chad Morris era, and people didn't really care at that point. So I just got to give that as an excuse.
You know, and I think that, I mean, to an extent, that's fair. Most of the non-conference games do get scheduled quite in advance. I think some people don't realize that entirely. And sometimes even before coaches change into there, I've seen that happen many a time when, I still remember when Idaho had to play at USC, the head coach wanted to get out of it because they'd scheduled it as like a nice thing for when a former USC assistant was the head coach at the time of Idaho when they booked it. He left after 2 years. They didn't fire him. He just went and joined USC's coaching staff again. But the new head coach was like, oh, great, I open at USC. Thanks, guys. And he was trying to get out of it, but he couldn't. But sometimes that's how it is. But, yeah, that Cincy game, man, I mean, you know, you asked about that. JD, serious, do you guys have thoughts on who you think has the edge in that game? I mean, I'm a little concerned for Cincy's talent level because they're returning a fair amount, but at the same time, they're best players, most – not all of them, but – a good chunk of them went in the draft.
I mean, I immediately lean Arkansas just for home field advantage. You have the consistency of your same coordinators, your same head coach. You know, Cincinnati ended up losing their offensive coordinator to LSU. We saw some changes within their assistant coaching staff, and they lost a large amount of NFL talent. Now, that's not to say that, you know, Luke Fickell hasn't been able to recruit at a good level for a G5, isn't able to coach them up. He's very capable of both and has shown that he's capable of both. But especially with a program like that, it's very difficult, especially not just to manage success, but to build on success. It's one thing to come in and, you know, come in from a disastrous tenure, which he did with Tommy Tuberville, kind of just leaving Cincinnati essentially in a pine box. But then to be able to build your own success, to build your own program, and then repeat that success is very, very difficult to do. Whereas with Sam Pittman, he is definitely building on success, but he's not building hype levels of, hey, we made the college football playoff last year as the first ever G5 team. His success is, hey, y'all, we made a bowl game. It was a decent one. We also won a couple of games that we shouldn't. We've got some momentum. Woo, pig suey. That's the kind of momentum that you want to be able to have in this type of opening game, not necessarily the coming down of, hey, guys, we tasted the creme de la creme. We got to be in the playoff last year. Now we got to figure out how to replace all this talent. Give me the hogs all day in this.
Yeah, and it's, you can replace talent to an extent, but Desmond Ritter ain't walking through that door in a couple weeks. And in the meantime, Sam Pittman's got KJ Jefferson coming back after a very, very strong showing last year. And, you know, probably a little bit of a chip on his shoulder wanting to, you know, kind of prove some doubters wrong, who he thought, you know, might have snubbed him some in terms of recognition after the season that he had last year. So, when it comes to the decision makers, the key talent, Arkansas is returning quite a bit. And that's going to play a big role in my mind.
Definitely.
Yeah. Thank you all for mentioning KJ. I do think he's a bit of a dark horse for, you know, there's great talent in the SEC and across the country for quarterback, but he's so fun to watch. And, you know, his shootout against Ole Miss and their quarterback last year is probably one of the most amazing games I remember for both quarterback play. But, yeah, KJ is going to be something special. I hope he just stays healthy.
Absolutely. And, Trey, thanks for joining us. We really appreciate it. So just as a quick station ID, you're listening to RCFB Talk 62. We're taking your calls. We always enjoy hearing from you. Cole, you've been patient. We'd love to hear from you.
Hey, yeah, thanks for having me on, guys. So I kind of have like a power rating versus, you know, normal rankings question. So, you know, there's various power rating systems out there and that aggregate basically have like every SEC West team, like power rated top 22 teams in the country. So basically half the teams in that division just based off that should like lose three games in our conference alone. So based off of all that, do you think a like 9-3 SEC West team deserves to be ranked higher than like an 11-1 or 10-2 ACC Pac-12 team?
It depends. I can't believe we beat the actual lawyer to the "it depends" response.
I was just waiting to see which one of you wanted to bite on this, because I'm like, I was like, I can think of a lot of SEC fans that would agree with that statement. Yes, of course the three loss SEC team should be ahead of the one loss ACC or Pac-12 team. But go ahead, JD. Probably go ahead, Sirius.
I'll actually take it a step further. I'll say it won't depend on the team. I'll say it depends on the rest of the conference, the rest of their division, because we've seen years where like Clemson has steamrolled the ACC and has not had any serious competition. And if they were 10-2 or, you know, 10-3 after winning the championship game, I mean, if they win the championship game, you kind of got to give them credit there, but they're 10-2. Versus a team that's 9-3, and the three losses are to teams that are all ranked in the top 10, then I think it gets pretty tough. Just in terms of, you know, if you're thinking about it from the sense of, could this team beat the other team on a neutral field based off of, you know, who they've played? Because when you play a conference that's down, it's just you don't get a lot of chances to prove yourself, to prove your ability. And without that, it makes it really tough versus if you hung with those three teams that you lost to, like if you lost to them by a field goal, maybe a touchdown, then I think a lot of voters are going to have a hard time saying that, you know, you should be knocked to it, because realistically, most of the teams in the country would have also lost those three games, and they probably would have lost them by an even bigger margin. So my gut response is it depends. If you get into particulars, you can argue it either way. But I don't think it's like crazy town to say that.
Yeah, it's not necessarily crazy town by any means to argue a 9-3 SEC team over an 11-1 ACC team. Again, it completely depends on the breaks. Like if the argument is, you know, 9-3 Alabama, let's go ahead and say the sky is falling. It's a 9-3 Alabama, but their losses are something along the lines of, you know, a 1-point loss to Texas A&M, a 2-point loss to let's call it Texas in an out of conference game. And then, you know, just a crazy Iron Bowl. But you're pacing them up against a Pitt team that's 11-1, where they get a bunch of squeakers in ACC play. You know, they've avoided Clemson this year in the regular season. They end up having no ranked wins, and their one loss is, again, let's say, for example, it's when they host Tennessee and they get blown out by 30 points at home. Well, yeah, that 9-3 team then probably does get ranked higher than the 11-1 Pitt. Now, granted, you could play that scenario in a bunch of different ways. You could tweak that to however you want. So the answer is still going to be, it depends. But to answer the original question, I can see scenarios where that can work out. And again, it's all going to completely depend on what's happening with the rest of the conference. We kind of mentioned it earlier with one of the previous calls, you know, when we were talking with Garrett about the volatility of the Big Ten and what they're going to have to do in non-conference play to really settle themselves as a conference. The same thing is going to apply to the SEC and to the ACC and to any other conference that's going to be out there. Because if you end up being the conference that wins a bunch of non-conference games, you get to win the early season narrative. You get to win the early season analytics of look at how much better this conference is able to perform over a different conference. So when they're playing each other, you get to have some kind of basis already of saying, hey, we know this team is in this conference. This conference is a little bit better than the others this year based on previous results. It's going to be completely dependent on all of that in order to make those types of situations work. But those scenarios are certainly possible. Yes, absolutely.
I think a prime example of that is 2014 Florida State, where we knew that they were not realistically a top three or even four team in the country. They squeaked into the playoffs at number four, despite the teams above them having more losses and them being undefeated, because everybody looked at them and they said, yeah, they're undefeated, but they haven't really beat anybody. And they haven't, the ones they, you know, all these people they have beat, they squeaked by most of them. You know, they were, you know, inches away from picking up a loss. If they had, they would have dropped in a hurry. And then of course they make the playoff and Oregon just absolutely destroys them in the Rose Bowl. So I think that that's kind of an example of the fact that you'll have teams where, yeah, they picked up a loss, but they're still a fantastic team and they may be better than a team with a better record.
I think to an extent that, again, you know, I always think of this as the reason why they created the committee for the CFP playoff selection, so they can do those kinds of comparisons that Cole is alluding to and we've been discussing. You know, Cole, what do you, you know, obviously you gave us a really good kernel of thought to talk about. What else did you want to mention? Is there anything else to it you wanted to add
to that specific point,
or whichever point? I mean, you brought up something really interesting.
Well, I guess kind of piggybacking off of that about the playoff committee that you mentioned. So I'm always curious, you know, just thinking if we'll ever get to a point to where, you know, the committee actually picks the best however many teams, you know, whether that's 4, 6, 8 or however many that is, rather than just like, you know, picking the best records or making sure the most conferences are in there for TV ratings and all that jazz. Because like the top two teams, basically everybody knows every year, you know, this year it's probably Alabama, Ohio State, Georgia, top two or three. But then the last however many spots, I just feel like so many politics get involved to where it's not actually the best, you know, 3, 4, 5 teams or whatever.
You know, it's always interesting when we hear the criticism of the playoff committee's choices. Because, and in a part, it's, I think it's because of the way that it's set up, where they release rankings pretty deep into the season when there's still a lot of football left to be played, and a lot of those rankings wind up changing by the time we get to the final selection. But at the end of the day, you know, you hear people talk about, oh, it was, you know, the BCS was so much better. Like, we didn't need a playoff committee. We just need the BCS to expand and take four instead of two. But there have been some simulations of who the BCS would have chosen, and I'm pretty sure that the choices are actually the exact same. Like, maybe there's some flip-flops in a couple of places, but like, the top four are consistently the top four. And, you know, a lot of times we get some uncompetitive games in the semis, but it's not consistent whether it's like the of which one is the uncompetitive team. We've seen some variations there. So I think in general, they've gotten the top four. They've done a pretty accurate job of it. I don't know how much like actual politics is involved. I mean, go back and talk about the Big Ten missing out on getting a team in there because of the whole like Baylor TCU situation. But at the same time, like, that's kind of their fault because they didn't have a system set up to actually name a champion. They just said, oh, no, they're both are equally the champions. And everybody's looking like, yeah, but we need to know which one is more champion than the other one. Kind of hoist by their own petard there, the fact that being too vague wound up being a problem. But I think overall the committee gets it right. People just aren't necessarily happy about it because of how teams shift around, you know, in the preceding weeks. But I think it's hard to look at it and say, you know, it should have been number five over number four or number six over number three or something like that. I think that most years the talent pool that we have for those top teams is just not deep enough. And expanding it out, like, we should be able to get some fluke upsets that aren't just going to be chalk. But I don't think there's going to be as much chaos as we see with, like, the NCAA tournament final with March Madness.
Well, Cole, just wanted to thank you for joining us. We're going to go ahead and keep this moving just because we want to get as many folks up as we can. But thanks again for joining us.
Yeah, thank you all for having me. And I agreed with basically everything you all said, so I know I'm in the right place.
Woohoo! Hey, Thack, you've been patient. What's up?
Hey, what's up, guys? How's it going? Can you hear me?
Sure can.
Hey, real quick, does anybody know when Paul Feinbaum's going to show up for work, dude? Somebody's going to start a Twitter account at this point, like, tracking the days he's not working, dude. He wasn't working on Monday. He wasn't working, you know, 3 weeks ago for, like, 3 days. I mean, dude, this guy must hate his job, dude. He's never there. He's never there. Somebody's got to start a Twitter account. Anyway, I want to talk about Missouri football, man. It's going to be a dumpster fire this year, man. Terrible. I love Missouri through and through. Missouri guy, man. Went there, graduated. It's going to be a terrible year. It's going to be a 4-5, maybe 5-win season. People are going to lose it. People are going to lose it. People are going to be at Drink's throat. They're trying to get him fired. People, for some reason, Missouri fans, ridiculous, dude. They think we're going to get seven win season. We're going to end up like Tennessee. By the way, Tennessee fans, you guys are delusional. Hoypel gets a 7-win season. You guys think he's the second coming of Christ. That tells you all you need to know about the downfall of Tennessee football right there. But, damn, I don't know. Mizzou football is going to be a dumpster fire this year. It got a lot of tough opponents in the SEC this year, a lot of good teams in the East that are, you know, historically haven't been very good. Arkansas, Tennessee, you know, they got Levis. I don't know how I feel about Levis, but, you know, Arkansas is going to be a tougher opponent for sure. You know, Tennessee, you're going to mop the floor with them because it's Tennessee. But I don't know, man. I just think Mizzou fans, I think even 6 wins is ridiculous. I think it's going to be a 5-win season. Going to start out. We're going to go Kansas State loss, dude. It's going to be downhill from there. But, yeah, I just wanted to rant. And, yeah, shout out Paul Feinbaum. Somebody got to get him back to work, dude. It's ridiculous.
Well, first and foremost, we will return Mr. Feinbaum to the SEC studios as soon as ESPN meets our demands. Negotiations have just gone completely cold. We can promise he's being well-fed. We're sending out the ransom videos every so often. You know, they can see that he's very well-nourished in our basement. But, you know, once ESPN finally coughs up the money that's needed, we'll go ahead and release Mr. Feinbaum to be back on the airwaves. Anyway, going on to Missouri, though, it's a very interesting time to be a Mizzou Tiger because obviously, when you're in the SEC, you're going to have a lot of huge competition. You've got Georgia, which is starting to become its own evil empire. It's won its first national championship. It continues to be reloading at an incredibly high caliber. And then, of course, you've got teams like Arkansas, which you are typically playing in a regular season setting as a protected rivalry, where Sam Pittman has now created a really strong team. Kentucky, almost seemingly out of nowhere after the last couple of years, they're starting to look really competitive and a possible number two in the SEC East. You've got Will Levis, who's a strong returning quarterback. Mark Stoops is now starting to get into arguments with John Calipari, of all people, on whether Kentucky is a basketball school. And I mean, South Carolina, if you've listened to any of our previous shows, you know that we have a huge affection for Shane Beamer and what the program he's building out there is. You've got Auburn again this year on the schedule, which whoever knows what Auburn is going to end up showing out with. But I'm not going to be as pessimistic with you. So I think one of the things for Drinkwitz is if he wins and gets into a bowl game, I think he's still safe. I don't think there's necessarily anybody at Missouri who is necessarily expecting them to play for a national championship or maybe even a New Year's Six anytime soon. But one of the things that I think is really, really positive for Drinkwitz is he does have a winnable enough schedule and he's bringing in some really high talent. I think recruiting a guy in like Luther Burden, the five-star wide receiver who was the top wide receiver prospect in the nation, bringing him into the school and making sure that he actually stayed inside of Missouri, I think that's a huge positive win for him. Drinkwitz still has the opportunity to get into a bowl game and kind of satisfy the fan base going out. And I mean, you've got winnable games with Louisiana Tech. You've got your FCS gimme with ACU. Auburn, who knows what Brian Harsin looks like at the very early part of the year after he's tried to get over a coup. Florida, Billy Napier, nobody really knows necessarily what they're looking at. South Carolina, that's going to be a really competitive game. You get to play Vanderbilt. So that's another possibility with a win. You've got Mississippi State. Hey, listen, spot the lie. Spot the line. Hey man,
we know, but you don't have to point it out.
I'm loving this Hawaii game, though, man. This is going to be like the Super Bowl. Vandy, Hawaii. Mark my words.
Oh, yes, absolutely. We're all excited for that game, and we're all excited to see college football come back. And even if, and I think this is the other thing that makes college football so beautiful, even if you're looking in at a pessimistic season or you're not super high on your coach, I guarantee you, you're going to be in front of your TV watching your Mizzou Tigers no matter what once the season starts. Am I right?
Hell yeah, you are, brother.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for coming on, man. We really, really appreciate you coming on. And like I said, Paul Feinbaum is in good condition. We will release him back once ESPN gives in to our demands. But until then, he is being well-nourished. He is getting enough water. We're letting him outside for some fresh air every so often under good supervision. He's fine. He's good. He'll be back on the air soon.
Hey, thanks, guys. I'm getting bored at work, man. I gotta get my 4 hours of Feinbaum in. Take it easy.
Thanks again, man. We appreciate it. So again, everyone, you're listening to RCFB Talk 62. We're listening to your calls as we get ready for week zero that's coming up. That should be fun. By the way, guys, I've been meaning to ask, which games are you looking forward to right now in week zero?
Oh, man. I mean, first and foremost, born and raised in Hawaii, Timmy Chang returning back to Honolulu, now the head coaches of his alma mater, the first kind of Hawaii test that we get with the Vanderbilt Commodores going into Honolulu and playing at TC Ching Complex. I'm very excited for that game. But and again, I think in the one that we are all very, very, I wouldn't necessarily say excited, but definitely ready to gawk at is going to be that Northwestern and Nebraska game that's going to be taking place in Ireland. Man, talk about an export of football to Europe and the opportunity to kind of see what Scott Frost is going to bring in a year that he is clearly on the hot seat, maybe on the hottest seat of any Power 5 college football coach for this year. But I think just between those two games, those are the ones that I am the most excited for.
Ditto, opposite side on the Vandy Hawaii game, obviously. But I feel like technically is going to be getting a real workout for the Nebraska Northwestern game. You know, technically, these are football teams. Technically, a game will get played. Just not really sure how much farther we can go than that. Because coming off of the seasons they had last year, not a lot to look forward to. You know, I think even Fitzgerald was commenting about it, you know, not a whole lot of questions for the coach of a team that won that few games last year.
Hey, just wanted to do another check to Andy and BuckyCast if you guys are able to unmute. Oh, BuckyCast, I see you're unmuted. What's up,
man? I did unmute. I didn't realize I had been called upon. My apologies.
No worries.
I am full of questions, but I'll try and limit it to just like maybe two. First of all, do you guys, everyone's been talking about Wisconsin, you know, are they a player in the Big Ten West? Are they on the decline? In your opinion, is Wisconsin overrated or underrated this year?
I think Wisconsin is rated. I don't Wisconsin. I feel like Wisconsin and Iowa are both in kind of a similar spot in my mind where they have been consistent for so long and usually not super flashy. Obviously, whenever Wisconsin gets like a big name running back, then they make waves. But even then, it's like running back flashy. It's not like high powered, you know, high flying offenses with lots of passing yards kind of flashy. So they're always, you know, in that position where if things go right, then they're going to be a contender in terms of winning the division, but maybe not quite good enough to win the conference. So that's kind of where they're stuck in my mind every year going into the season is, all right, yeah, they're probably somewhere in the, you know, in the teens in the rankings with the potential to be like, you know, maybe get up to number 8, possibly number 6 in a really good year. But at the same time, like, yeah, maybe if they have a bad year, they could drop down into the 20s, but it's probably not going to be a total dumpster fire. I don't know. That's just kind of like my year-to-year opinion for Wisconsin is just that they're consistent. They are very solidly Midwestern in terms of how they go about their business. So,
We're very polite.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you know, it's not quite Minnesota nice, but, you know, it reminds me of the Wisconsinites that I know. So, yeah, that's kind of where they are in my mind. I don't know. It's just kind of a hard thing to predict with them because it's part what they do, but it's also part what everybody else does. If somebody comes out with a real hot hand, you know, if this is the year where Northwestern decides to go crazy again, then who knows what's going to happen. But at the same time, it could just wind up being a dogfight between them and Iowa, and it's going to be muddy in the trenches, and somebody's going to win like 17 to 15.
That's fair. That's fair. By the way, Minnesota nice is a myth. They're not nice at all.
Hey, now. I'm a transplant. I'm SoCal. I don't care. I feel like the rudest person in the entire state and I'm from LA, which if you understand that, that doesn't make any sense. But but I mean, at least the Badgers seem to have more competent football overall. I mean, that consistency is also competency, and the Gophers will manage to lose in spectacular ways. It never makes sense. Go ahead.
One other semi-quick question. It's a little bit of an obscure take on college football expansion. Is there a circumstance that you could see where, because like Florida and Texas A&M, they're AAU schools, the Big Ten is going to renegotiate their media contract before the SEC is going to get a chance to renegotiate theirs? And we all know more expansion is coming. Is there any circumstance where you would see a school like, say, Florida or Texas A&M, if the Big Ten could pitch them, hey, you'll make this much more money than in the SEC, and you'll be the only Big Ten school in Texas or the only Big Ten school in Florida if the SEC decides to add Miami or Florida State or both? Would that ever work? Do you think that would ever happen?
Boy, I think personally I could see the Big Ten. I mean, because everyone was kind of wondering in the back of their heads, would, you know, that AAU thing, would the Big Ten make a play at, say, Georgia Tech? Because then they would be almost certain to say yes. And then you have the ATL, you know, you've got a huge market suddenly. I think especially a school like Texas A&M, but especially Florida. I mean, Florida is hardcore SEC, and it's been good to them. They've been good to it. I would be shocked to see them manage to do that. Again, Miami, again, a stronger chance because, again, you're in that market, and the ACC can't necessarily offer something that would be rivaling what the Big Ten could. But I don't foresee And again, guys, I'd love to see hear if you think otherwise. But I couldn't ever see, frankly, vice versa. It's hard at this point to imagine the SEC or the Big Ten picking off, you know, teams from either one, unless one team is just furious with their conference, which, you know, money solves that problem pretty quick. So it's
what about Missouri? I think you just talked about Missouri.
Yeah, but Missouri gets to collect paychecks. They're like the Purdue of the SEC right now, right? I mean, so I don't believe I just phrased it that way. But you know what I mean? It's like, yeah, but they get to collect checks and, you know, occasionally, hopefully have a great season. And no one's necessarily expecting Mizzou to constantly compete for a college football playoff spot or even a New Year's Six spot. But they get to certainly get the funds it takes to build a program that is otherwise, you know, leaps and bounds above the others. What do you guys think?
I think that the projections right now are for the SEC plus Texas and Oklahoma to be somewhere in the 100 million plus a year range when all of those contracts get renegotiated, because you have to remember, like, right now payouts are abnormally low because the CBS money's still there. So as soon as the CBS contract switches to ESPN, there's going to be a big bump. And then once Texas and OU get it brought in, then there's going to be another bump. So I don't know that right now it's flashy because the Big Ten's, you know, negotiating their contract. So we have some hard numbers, but I don't think the SEC is going to be that uncompetitive by the time we get everybody expanded out. So I don't know that there's going to be that big of a draw of, you know, ditch your conference mates in order to come to the Big Ten to make 10 or 20 million more a year, maybe. And also have, you know, increased travel costs and all this other stuff. I mean, Florida baseball would absolutely kill in the Big Ten. Don't get me wrong. But beyond that, I don't know if there's going to be that much of an allure. And in terms of what teams they might be interested in, you know, one of the things that's come up with the current discussions about which Pac-12 teams might go is the fact that you need to be a net add. You don't need to drop the average payout just to, you know, increase the number of teams. So you need to bring a media market and a fan base that's going to be big enough and a big enough get that you're actually going to increase what you can get from the networks. And there's not a whole lot of cities that are capable of pulling those numbers. So, you know, yeah, Atlanta could be one. I don't know that Georgia Tech moves the needle enough on it, though. You know, it's kind of like the whole, you know, if I do like the Elon Musk, like taking a drag of the joint and talk about Vandy going to the Big Ten so that they can get the Nashville media market, you know, that kind of insanity. But
I guess I'm kind of wondering, though, because they're almost trying to reach Big Ten alumni more than they are necessarily a fan base.
It doesn't matter what they – but that doesn't matter because what
– That was the Rutgers thing for sure is what part of the reason why that was attracted. Not just New York, but so many Big Ten alums live in New York on top of course, Chicago.
And you can quote the alum thing as being like a reason, but at the end of the day, it's all about what the – your media partners are going to pay you the most for, which is eyeballs on television sets. And if nobody in that metro area is actually going to tune in for your conference games, then it doesn't matter. So that's important in order to get that higher fee of the fact that it's in your footprint or your watershed, you know, however you want to phrase it. And that's going to be what moves the needle, I think, now. You know, we're talking about the fact that, like, Seattle and Portland might not be big enough to increase the payouts for the Big Ten, considering where they're at right now. So in light of that, you know, does Georgia Tech and Atlanta have enough clout to move the needle? And if you bring anybody else in, they're going to have to be extremely competitive. Like, no, Tuscaloosa media market is not going to be huge, but Alabama is a massive brand and they would bring eyeballs. You know, kind of that mentality of it. If you're talking about a team that's not got a huge metro area that will actually tune in for their games.
Well, Bucky Cass, thanks so much for joining us. It was great hearing from you again, man. It's been a while, but I remember last time we heard from you.
Yeah, I'm just John from the Bucky cast. We have many other members, but none of them are crazy enough to stay up till after 10 o'clock Central to talk about obscure expansion plans. So,
brother, we will talk about Japanese Division II football here. So we are quite bonkers when it comes to this stuff. I mean, we love the Sickos committee because we've been there before they made it a brand.
Do I have questions for you then about Japanese Division II football?
They've got promotion and relegation, which is what makes it kind of fun to watch if you can get into it. Because I mean, I'm gonna say this real quick because those of you out there might find this fascinating. Because everyone, when people hear it, they're like, "Why don't we do this at in the NCAA?" And there's a lot of reasons why it would never work. But at the end of the season, they don't just have a postseason for the winners. The top two teams in the best conferences go on to the playoff and play basically the equivalent of G5 teams and wipe them out and then just play each other for the title. The bottom two teams at every level then have to play the top two teams at the division below them. It isn't automatic relegation and promotion. What happens is the bottom two teams in the Division I there, and I think the two big conferences have eight teams, they're vertically integrated. So it's the same conference. It's like Conference Division I, like the SEC had SEC Division II. The top two finishers in Division II and the top two teams in Division III play the bottom two above them. And if they win, if the top Division II team beats, it's like it's a postseason game. So it's like a loser's bowl or a winner's bowl, depending on how you look at it, except it's sudden death. So if the team that finished at the bottom of D1 loses to the team that finished at the top of D2, they switch places next season. But if the bottom of Division I wins, they stay. Those are stakes that make being a fan of a bad team really interesting. But you can imagine that could turn into some real messes in, especially if you spent all that SEC money building a giant stadium and then suddenly you get dropped into a different conference with a totally different payout. That, there's a lot of reasons why there's too much money at stake, unfortunately, for that to happen here. But dang, is it fun to imagine.
I don't know why that's an issue. I mean, Cal football still exists, and they've got a massively, over-indebted stadium.
Oh, well, yeah, they're hoping they'll get a pick-me situation like UCLA just did to bail them out, right?
I did leave out the part where they're in a poverty conference.
Yeah. Oh, goodness. Brady, you've been really patient. We'd love to hear from you.
Thanks for having me on, guys. So I'm a Cornhusker, and I just have to say I am super, super nervous for this Saturday. Maybe it's just PTSD from last year's week zero game and that disaster of a performance, but I don't know. It kind of just feels like a one game season heading into Saturday. If we can't get past Northwestern, then I don't know. I don't know if there's any coming back from that. If I'm being honest, if we can – I don't really care if it's a two-point win, a 40-point win, is getting out of there with a W, picking up some wins against Georgia Southern and North Dakota and building some momentum in the Oklahoma game. That's really all I care about is escaping – Dublin at the moment, because like I said, it's a one game season. It feels like,
I know this offseason has kind of hyped it up to make it feel like this is a one and done game for Scott Frost, especially if he loses this game. Granted, if you're a Cornhusker fan, you want Scott Frost to be everything that was promised and delivered when he came from UCF and be the head coach that brings Nebraska back to glory. But let me throw it on the other flip side. So let's say, for example, it's another classic Scott Frost loss, but this time it's in Ireland to Northwestern. One of the flip sides is you could now look forward to the season of how, in the most humorous ways, can my team lose this one? I've seen these types of games before in cheering for teams that, have not had great seasons in the past. But there are always some exciting times of like, entertain me with how you're going to lose this one this time. Make me entertained on this. So I'm just going to throw it out there as a silver lining of, you don't get the W out in Dublin. There's always the opportunity of, hey, I might get disappointed in a new way.
Yeah, that's a good way to look at it. But you'd think by now we'd done all we can, find almost every way to lose. But it's never fails. Week after week, they always surprise you.
He lost on a pick two safety. I didn't know they could do that.
Yeah.
You don't get to be the greatest 3-9 team in the history of college football without finding new and exciting ways to lose games, okay?
Very true, man.
I'm now waiting for this to happen in some way so that the referees in Ireland, you know, obviously they're American referees, but I'm just waiting to watch everyone in the stadium, all the Irish fans who've decided to just come and check out a game, just as confused as everyone in the stadium as they tried to kind of resolve this last critical play of the game. And then everyone would just leave disgusted, no matter who won. That would be a beautiful way to remind Ireland of our beautiful game. I think that would be spectacular.
Oh yeah.
And then give everyone a runza on their way out, you know?
Yeah, I mean, kidding. Yeah, they got to get the Nebraska experience with the runza sandwich, I tell you what.
Awesome. Hey, Brady, thanks for joining us, man. That was awesome.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
So, Hob, you've been really patient. We'd love to hear from you.
Hey, can you hear me? Hey, I just want to say I'm a West Virginia Mountaineer fan. I think we're going to have a solid year. I think we're going to beat Pitt and at least win 8 or 9 games, I think. And I also wanted to point out that I'm that crazy-ass West Virginia fan that said Marshall's going to beat Notre Dame on the Reddit college football page yesterday, and I maintain that. Marshall's going to beat Notre Dame week 2. I feel it in my bones.
When you feel it in your bones, that's when you know that is an Appalachian guarantee. I love it.
Yeah, let's fucking go.
Listen, this is going to be a really big year for Neil Brown. I know that he's feeling a little bit of pressure going into year 4, trying to turn around West Virginia's luck, try to make it back into that kind of Big East dynasty that it used to be under Rich Rod, under all these other previous coaches like Dana Holgorsen, and try to bring back that kind of glory back to the Mountaineers. But you know what? There is absolutely nothing, a little bit of moon. Moonshine, hope, and some pepperoni rolls can't feed into your soul to make you believe.
I will drink to that, brother.
Oh, man. I love it. Well, if Marshall does pull it off, man, we're gonna remember this one for sure. We're going to have you back on. We're going to have a long chat about, you know, what your other predictions are for the future. Because
It is weird because, like, I'm not even a Marshall fan, but, like, half of my family are all Marshall graduates. We raised right outside Charleston, West Virginia. I'm a massive WVU fan. I went to WVU. My uncle went to WVU. But, like, the rest of my family went to Marshall. So they hate WVU with a passion. But, like, I have a respect for Marshall. I have a disdain for Virginia Tech, Pitt. But other than that, you know, I have a massive herd on when they're playing Notre Dame week 2. And I'm going to be a massive, massive Marshall fan this year for some reason. We don't play them. Say, as long as we don't play them, I don't have a quarrel with them. Because, I mean, I can't hate a team that ain't never beat us. But, I mean, you know, that's just me. That's neither here nor there. But
you know, and I love all your perspective on this only because I've had friends from who went to Marshall or went to Virginia Tech. And yeah, just hearing that dynamic between West Virginia University, you know, Marshall, BT, and Pitt, it's glorious, that whole area. And I mean, Marshall's always kind of, you know, like the stepchild in all of it. But, you know, it's just, I love the passion and rivalry between all those schools and just kind of that dynamic that you get from all of them. And
don't get me wrong. I growing up, I've been to well over 100 Mountaineer games in my lifetime, or close to it. The first game I was ever at was when I was 10 years old in Blacksburg, when we were ranked 7th, and we had Pac-Man and Chris Henry, rest in peace, and Virginia Tech kicked the dog shit out of us. But that was still cool. But ever since then, like the past decade, it's been pretty sweet watching Texas and Oklahoma and Oklahoma State come to town. But I miss watching Pitt, Virginia Tech, Boston College, Miami. I miss the old Big East. I wish it was back. It's never coming back. But, like, I can always say, like, I got to watch that at least.
Well, thanks again for joining us, Hob. It was great hearing from you. Let's see here. Air Raid Authority, you've been really patient. We got time for about 2 more callers, but Air Raid Authority, we'd love to hear from you.
Hey, how's it going, guys?
Good.
Hey, yeah, I had kind of a more of an open-ended question, more of a general one. And correct me if I'm wrong on this information, but to my knowledge, since there's been the 247 player ratings, the only national champions have been teams that have stacked four top 10 classes in a row. And again, correct me if I'm wrong. My question is, do you see a path for a team that's consistently recruiting in the top 15 or 20 or 25, maybe being able to break that mold? And if so, what qualities in that team would you expect to see to break that mold? Would it be an elite quarterback play? Would it be like a longstanding culture, like one we see at Utah with Kyle Whittingham, where, you know, he's been there a really long time? And, you know, what are going to be some of the challenges for a team like that to overcome to break that mold?
So to answer your first question, teams that did not stack a bunch of top 10 recruiting classes together, you'd have to look back to 2010 and Auburn for the last time that that didn't happen. And of course, that was essentially Cam Newton had one of the greatest seasons in the history of the sport, doing transcendent play at quarterback for Auburn in what was a very weird year in college football in general. I mean, that was something where I think it was him and Nick Fairley were like the only two that ended up getting picked in the NFL draft off of that entire team. Just an absolutely bizarre year in college football. But again, one of the great years that we had in college football. That being said, I think one of the biggest issues that's going to happen is you need those top 10 teams, because those teams that are getting those top five teams over and over and over again, I mean, that's going to be your Alabama. That's going to be your Georgia. That is increasingly becoming your Texas A&M. You've got some other folks that are also up there in that very high top five, high top 10, pulling in those huge recruiting classes where, you know, it's almost to the point of if you're number 10, you're barely going to start making it to the New Year's Six games, because these guys who are actually going up there and getting these top three classes every single year are just reloading over and over again. Now, of course, there's going to be a lot of opportunity for other teams to, you know, come up, step up. There's still going to be coaching. There's still going to be development. Cincinnati was a great example this last year of you can make it to the playoffs without top 10 classes every single year. But the idea that you're going to win a national championship, I think that's becoming very, very much a pipe dream for people who are not recruiting at that level, because recruiting has gotten that much more advanced, that more scientific, and that more specific on what these players are actually made of when they come out of high school. Now, on the other hand, one of the things that we're still kind of in the early years for is the advent of NIL. And what that means for, you know, programs who can suddenly start to throw out a little bit of money, try to entice some marketing opportunities for these players. And then, of course, you know, the transfer portal of every college football player has also been a really big leveler for the game. I mean, I immediately think to, you know, Joe Burrow transferring out of Ohio State because it wasn't a perfect situation for him. And then he had one of the greatest quarterback seasons of all time at LSU in 2019 and made Ed Ogeron, of all people, a national championship winning coach. And I mean, Sirius, you know a lot about the transfer portal as well and things that will end up happening to teams who know how to recruit out of the transfer portal. I mean, what's the opportunity that you get with transfers that you wouldn't necessarily get from an elite recruiting class?
Texas State's going to win it all. You heard it here first. Transfer portals, you know, that's the key. No, in all seriousness, I think that, like JD said, the transfer portal is going to be pretty key in trying to make a run happen. But I think it's going to be tricky because, you know, you mentioned some teams like, you know, Utah and other teams that have been known for developing talent. And I think that the developing talent is going to be key. The stability is going to be key. You want a coach and coaching staff who are there year after year after year so that they can coach guys up into their system. So I think that at that point, if you're working your way up into making a run at a national title, then if everything's going according to plan, in theory, you should be getting some of those high recruits because, you know, we say top 10, the top 10 cutoff for 2022, North Carolina was number 11. They had 2 5-stars. LSU had one. Oregon had one. Kentucky is sitting there at 14 with no 5-stars at all. A lot of 4-stars, but no 5s. So realistically, like if you're in the top 10, that means you got 1 or 2 5-stars in your roster. If you're consistently winning 10 or 11 games, building your way up, then in theory, you should be able to at least snag one or two, depending on your geographics. That's where it hurts teams like Utah and places that aren't in talent-rich areas. But then I think that if you're not able to get up into that top 10, then yeah, you're going to have to rely on using, you know, NIL and specifically the transfer portal to find guys that are talented, that are buried on a depth chart and want the chance to play immediately, who have the ability to elevate an already good to great program to national title contending program. Think it kind of like what happened with, Spencer Rattler transferring with to South Carolina, and what that means for that South Carolina program being able to get talent like that, that they didn't pick up through normal recruiting. And right now the transfer aspect isn't really accounted for well in the recruiting rankings. So it's still a work in progress. So I think that that's going to be key to getting that next boost to get you over the hump. If you're, you know, a team that's on the outside looking in, because we've seen some, you know, dark horse Heisman candidates that have popped up on some of these teams that aren't blue bloods, aren't, you know, bringing in blue chips left and right. So I think it's possible. And maybe it's a team that normally does have that, that has access to good recruits, but just was coming off of a down mark. You know, Florida was number 17 in Billy Napier's partial first year. You know, maybe he kind of turns it around there, brings in some transfer guys, and all of a sudden gets them back up into national prominence. So I think it's possible. You know, Cincinnati got really close, and it's not like they were a top 10 recruiting team, but they built up guys. And I would say last point is probably the other chance that you could see is if you're running some kind of a different scheme where you're not taking the guys that Alabama and Georgia and Ohio State are. You know, if you're running a Mike Leach type offense, not necessarily an air raid offense, but you're doing something that's different, that utilizes guys with a different skill set that the NFL isn't necessarily looking for, which now, you know, air raid quarterbacks are doing pretty well in the NFL finally, or these big name programs are, then you might be able to find some guys that are overlooked by the rating services because they have a different skill set. And we see that from time to time where you get teams that are better than the on the field than they are on paper because they're just different.
Well, I just want to thank you, Area Authority, for joining us. That was great. You know, David, you've been patient. We're going to have you as our last caller. We'd love to hear from you.
Awesome. How are you doing?
We're good, man. How are you?
I'm doing well, man. Thank you. Yeah, so I just wanted to talk about Texas A&M real quick. Not an A&M fan, by the way, but I just wanted to talk about them real quick. And I have a take that I've believed for a while, and it might sound like a hot take, but I just wanted to get your thoughts on it. But I have an opinion that if Jimbo Fisher doesn't produce at least one championship with this monster class that he brought in, or at the very least, if he doesn't make the playoffs at least once with this class that he brought in, then he should be let go. Now, you know, some might think that's too harsh just because of the history of A&M. They've never really been a team like that. And, of course, being in a division with Alabama, I get that. But the way that I look at it, you know, I'm looking at his class right now on 24/7, and he signed, you know, I think it was the where is it? Oh, here it is. The number 2 overall quarterback, the number 3 overall receiver, and then I think he signed the number 5 overall running back. So guys at key positions and all that. And so I think when you sign a class like that, that's so good, you're inviting potential scrutiny. And I'm just envisioning myself as the AD, you know, let's say the years go by and he doesn't produce a championship or even make the playoffs. And I'm looking at him and I say to him, you brought in arguably the best recruiting class of all time and you have nothing to show for it. So I just want to know if you think that's a hot take or if you think there's some, you know, if you think that's reasonable. Because that's what I think, but I just like to hear your thoughts on that.
Part of me was reminded of some of those kind of do nothing but really highly touted teams that USC had on the field back. I mean, I'm going far back. I'm going to like the mid-90s because that was when the LA Times used to say USC was all talent and no results. But how many years are we going to give him with this class? Are you saying like the full 4 years with this class or thinking like 2 or 3 years?
I'm thinking more like 2 or 3 years because I imagine that, you know, that a bunch of these guys are probably going to declare for the draft in their third year.
Well, certainly, and I mean, it was interesting. We had a talk, gosh, a couple weeks ago with John Talty, who had written a book about the leadership skills and strategies of Nick Saban. And certainly the thing that was the biggest takeaway was exactly how important recruiting is to his entire coaching philosophy. Like, he kind of bends everything around that. I mean, I think in the book he joked when he was hired by Alabama, like, he hired the best recruiter there ever is and kind of a whatever coach. You know, he was kind of being a little bit, obviously, self-effacing there. But at the same time, you know, I think that's what it's going to boil down to. Jimbo, is he going to take that approach? Is he going to keep being the and tapping into this behemoth that is the Texas A&M fan base and what they can do when they really want something, especially now that they can do so much above board, you know, with NIL, et cetera. Are they going to now start bringing in the talent? And then can he, though, be that CEO coach who brings in the right assistants, or will he be the one to lead it as a doing some of his own play calling to take advantage of the talent that gets poured in? Because certainly if you bring in enough talent, you'll maybe perhaps squeak by some games based on just that. But, yeah, it's going to be a big question on whether or not he can bring in or coach them to the talent level they are at. JD, serious, what do you think about that?
I mean, in terms of you know, do you risk getting a little bit too much examination, too much scrutiny for signing too good of a class? You know, at the same time, at what level would it not be worth it? You know, the NCAA has gotten pretty toothless in recent years because teams have figured out you just don't cooperate with them and they don't really have a leg to stand on in terms of their investigations because they can't subpoena you. It's all, you know, a voluntary participation process, basically. So, you know, we haven't seen those big penalties like we used to. So, I mean, if you've got the chance to recruit guys and you know that everybody else is doing some shady stuff still, then why stop at, you know, number two if you can get number one, or if you get number one by an even bigger margin, then why not go for it? As far as that aspect of it goes, it just, I don't know that the risk is anywhere near outweighing the reward in terms of signing the absolute best class with the best players that you possibly can, especially when you've got an in-state rival that's going to be a conference rival in a few years who is going out and signing some really big names too. So it's going to be quite the arms race in Texas if, you know, oil prices stay up.
At least all I know for this exercise, you know, if I'm the coach who gets to make any of those kind of decisions and I have to worry about, you know, is the NCAA going to investigate this or anything else like that, I just make sure that I got a really nice buyout already written into my contract, and I go hire David Beatty's lawyers and not Jeremy Pruitt's lawyers to make sure that I get that money when the NCAA starts to investigate me. That's all I got to say about that.
Oh, boy. Well, you know, David, I just want to say thanks for joining us because we're now, oh my gosh, we're almost at 1 hour and 40 minutes of a call-in show. That's it's been a while since we've had one of these. Hey, David, thanks for joining us, by the way. I just wanted to, I know, hopefully we got most of what you asked for. I know we kind of, I think we're running out of juice on our side.
Yeah, no worries. I appreciate you giving me the platform. Thanks, guys. And go Gators, by the way.
Yeah, I noticed that you were a Gators fan, and you want to, yeah, absolutely. And, hopefully you guys will have a great opener, as we said to the earlier caller, in the swamp with Utah. That's going to be an interesting game to see, for sure. Good luck.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Well, everyone out there, we just wanted to say thank you for tuning in. On behalf of all of us, myself, Bob Akairi, JD, Sirius, thank you all for joining us. It was great hearing from all of you. We're, as I said, in the middle of the broadcast, we're going to try and continue these call-in shows on Tuesday nights and move guests elsewhere, so that we can hear from you, because you guys are a big part of what we enjoy and why we do this. So thank you all for joining us. Now I'm gonna hang up and listen.